done.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Bush has called for America to revamp its energy policy and reduce its dependence on foreign oil. If that sounds similar to the messages that have been coming from the White House for the last three decades, that's because it is. Yet American consumption of foreign oil keeps growing. Tonight on Point, grading the Bush energy plan in light of a generation of failed plans. But first, Palestinian Authority Chairman Yasser Arafat has named ally and longtime supporter Hakim Balawi as acting security chief. This position is a crucial one for the success of the peace process. Arafat's move is sure to deepen the rift between him and Palestinian Prime Minister Ahmed Koure, who threatened on Sunday to resign. I asked Greg Myrie, a Jerusalem-based correspondent for the New York Times, about Koure's rift with Arafat.
He's been fighting with Yasser Arafat really for the past month. He was nominated immediately after the previous prime minister, Mahmoud Abbas, resigned on September 6th. Mr. Koure has been struggling for a month to put together a cabinet. He was installed by a decree by Yasser Arafat a week ago. They're fighting over a number of issues. The most important one is who will be the Palestinian security chief. This is a very important position because it will be the person who would give orders to the security forces about how they should act against Palestinian militants, and this has been an issue that the Israelis and the Americans have been insisting on Palestinian action. This is a major point of dispute, and it could torpedo his government before it ever really gets going.
And this was the same source of dispute between Mr. Abbas and Mr. Arafat as well.
Correct. Again, this is really the overriding issue, particularly from the Israeli and American perspective. They say that Mr. Arafat has not used his security forces to act against the Palestinian militants throughout the 3 years of fighting here. They don't want to deal with him, and they want to see a Palestinian prime minister that will have some independence, have some authority, and can control the security forces and use them as he sees fit. So that's what the Americans and the Israelis want. Now, having said that, Mr. Koure, the new prime minister, is taking the same position as his predecessor and saying he doesn't intend to wage a major crackdown against the militants. He's saying that could lead to a Palestinian internal conflict, a civil war even, and his effort will be to persuade militants to stop attacks. So it's a very messy, complicated situation, but I think the bottom line is the Palestinians are having real trouble getting their political act together at a time when they're facing tremendous pressure from the Israelis in terms of military raids and a breakdown of the peace process.
Where is this going? I mean, we read that there's some talk about the Palestinian Authority even dissolving itself and effectively saying, we give up to the Israelis, you rule us, and let's see how things go. In effect, to sort of confront the international community with the complete breakdown of the roadmap and even of the Palestinian entity. Is there talk of that?
There definitely is talk about this. This is something we're hearing more and more about. We're not seeing any specific action in that direction, but a lot of Palestinian academics and intellectuals and politicians are saying, look, Israel controls us entirely. They have their troops and their security forces surrounding our cities. Our government, our Palestinian Authority, can't act in any meaningful way. Let's just dissolve ourselves in terms of the Palestinian government and make it Israel's problem that they have to provide services, they have to provide government. And I think the Israelis are genuinely reluctant to return to that kind of situation. That's what we saw change in the early and mid-90s as the peace talks began. Israel started pulling out of Palestinian cities and gave the Palestinians this limited autonomy. The Palestinians saying, you've taken it away from us, we don't have it anymore, let's not pretend that we have a meaningful government. Now, Mr. Arafat and the Palestinian leaders are not talking like that or not saying that, but you are hearing that, and it is being discussed in Palestinian papers and among academics and intellectuals.
Well, the dead end, or the seeming dead end of the roadmap that has brought on this such speculation, sort of raised interest in another roadmap. What is the Geneva Initiative we're reading about in the Jerusalem Post, and does this offer any hope now that the formal roadmap seems to have reached an end?
Yes, it's very true. The formal roadmap is really not going anywhere and is in big trouble. We have a very interesting development. And this is this Geneva understanding or Geneva initiative, as it's being called. What has happened over the past 2 years is some prominent Israeli and Palestinian politicians have been getting together trying to work out what they would say could be a future agreement. Now, these are not politicians in power. They're liberal left-wing Israelis, some of them members of the previous government that attempted a peace deal and failed and are very much at odds with the current Sharon government. On the Palestinian side, it involves people who are have held senior positions and are very close to Yasser Arafat and would seem to have some backing for this effort, if not formal support. What they've done is come up with a very detailed 50-page document. They're planning to have a formal signing ceremony in Geneva next month, and it details exactly how they would like to see this conflict solved. It gets into the tough issues that have traditionally been put aside, like how to divide up Jerusalem, which neighborhoods in Jerusalem would become part of a Palestinian capital, which Israeli settlements would be allowed to remain in Israeli hands, and which ones would be given to the Palestinians. What would happen to the 4 million Palestinian refugees? So it tackles head-on all of these questions, and it offers some very interesting proposals about how to solve them. Now, these have no official sanction, and the Israeli government came out very harshly against this, calling it a very irresponsible freelance diplomatic effort. Palestinians, I'm sure, will have criticism as well on the issues about the return of refugees. So it's not clear that this thing will go anywhere, but it's very interesting that we do have prominent politicians on both sides sitting down, coming up with a very detailed document at a time when the overall peace effort is in such shambles.
And this document, unlike the roadmap, has gone right to the big issues at the end of everything, namely the right of return on the one side and the settlements on the other. What is it proposed on both of those?
On the right of return, and this we're talking about the 4 million or so Palestinian war refugees and their descendants who live, well, all over the Middle East and further afield, they would be allowed under this plan to return to a Palestinian state or perhaps move to another state, perhaps move to a Western country or stay where they are and receive compensation. They would not be allowed to return to their old land inside Israel, which has been their demand for decades, for a half century. Unless Israel gave them permission. And Israel previously, or previous Israeli governments, the Barak government of a few years ago, had said it might allow some number, perhaps tens of thousands, but certainly not millions, to come back. So this would be a huge concession if the Palestinians were to agree to that and accept that position. Now, the Israelis said the concession they made would be to give the Palestinians full sovereignty or full control of the most important and contested religious shrine in Jerusalem, which is the noble sanctuary, as the Muslims call it, and the Temple Mount, as the Israelis call it. A Muslim religious authority already has control of this, and Israel would, in effect, be ceding its claim of sovereignty. And again, this would be a hugely explosive issue on the Israeli side to give up this place, this shrine, which is considered the holiest site in Judaism. So we can see how difficult it could be for these things to win acceptance. Even if they win a majority acceptance, there'll be hugely vocal groups trying to oppose this. But it is sort of getting people talking about what would have to be done for an eventual settlement of some sort.
Greg, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Greg Myrie is a Jerusalem correspondent for the New York Times. He spoke with me from Jerusalem. The president has said the energy bill in Congress will wean America from foreign oil. Drilling in Alaska is part of the plan. Tighter emissions requirements, it's not. The bill is packed with incentives for industry to build cleaner cars and develop alternate energy sources. But Don Barlett argues in his October 13 Time magazine article, The Great Energy Scam, that many of the incentives will not work because policies like them, which cost the taxpayers billions, have failed before. Tonight we look at how Bush's plan stacks up. Why can't America, with its ample subsidies to promote different energy sources, break its dependence on foreign oil? Will market forces ever lead companies on a green path? Do you want an energy bill that focuses on production or on conservation? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Philadelphia is Donald Barlett. He is editor-at-large of Time and winner of two Pulitzer Prizes. His story, The Great Energy Scam, appeared in the October 13 issue of the magazine. He is co-author of America, What went wrong. Don Barlett, many thanks for joining us.
Jack, it's a pleasure to be with you.
We're going to get into this bill and the subsidies that are in it, subsidies for development of hydrogen-fueled vehicles, subsidies for the nuclear power industry, for the gas industry, for the oil industry. But I think we need to examine these subsidies in the light of the cautionary tale you have to tell us about the Synfuel, and what a Dickensian title name that is, the Synfuel subsidy, and what it's and sort of what that means for the future, and what it sort of augurs for these plans based on subsidizing energy. Tell us where and what Synfuels. How did this saga get going, and how has it been perpetuated over the years?
I really liked your description of that, Jack. You really have to go back to the energy crisis of the 1970s, the twin shortage periods, and Congress at that time came up with its subsidy program to make sure that we would never have to depend on foreign oil again. And among the subsidies was one to produce synthetic fuel oil and synthetic natural gas out of coal, in particular, or oil shale.
Mm-hmm.
They built pilot plants everywhere. There was nothing revolutionary about this. The Germans ran their war machine on this technology. And there were pilot plants built all across the United States. There were no commercial facilities built, and by 1982, the whole thing had collapsed, and that was kind of the end of the story. But the tax credit remained in the books, and as is always the case when there are tax credits, by the mid-90s, someone combing the code had come up with it, and they found a new way to use it, and they, in a way it was never envisioned when Congress enacted the credit. And basically what's happened—
Can we just interrupt? A tax credit is a subsidy. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's important to distinguish between a credit and a deduction. A credit mm-hmm. is a dollar-for-dollar write-off against mm-hmm. the taxes a company owes. So if a company owes $10 million for selling widgets over here, and it owes $10 million in taxes, and it gets a $10 million tax credit in its Synfuel business, it pays no taxes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a straightaway dollar-for-dollar subsidy.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it doesn't work if the company is not profitable. It only works for those companies that are profitable and seriously profitable.
Mm-hmm.
So you come up to the late 1990s, and all of a sudden about 57 of these plants materialize across the country. And they're turning coal into, quote, as you put it very well, a Dickensian way, Synfuel. Except when you go to these plants, what you see is coal going in a conveyor belt into a building, and something that looks very much like coal coming out the other side of the building and heading to public, mostly to electric utilities. Some of it's exported. In return, they get $26 a ton tax credit on the new Synfuel. Inside the plant, there are different processes that are used, but they're loosely referred to as spray and pay, in that they spray the coal with various chemicals to change the chemical composition, which is the requirement of the Internal Revenue Code. And then they pray that nobody takes a look at it. And that's what's been going on. And it's been very profitable. I mean, you have Progress Energy down in Florida has collected almost $1 billion in tax credits. And you have a lot of people in this business now who are really not electric utilities, but other companies like Marriott Corporation has done quite well by lowering its tax rate from about 36% to 6%. Simply by virtue of its investment in the Synfuel plants.
6% is a lower rate than anybody, even the poorest person in America, pays.
Any individual who's paying income taxes is paying at a higher rate.
Don, hold that thought for a minute. We're talking tonight about energy subsidies and Bush's plan to reduce America's dependence on foreign oil. With natural gas supplies falling, with Persian Gulf oil always unsure, are you afraid of a new energy crisis? How would you like to change Bush's energy bill? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about America's energy policy, tax credits, and the energy bill in Congress. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Donald Barlett. He's editor-at-large at Time, Inc. and winner of two Pulitzer Prizes. His story, The Great Energy Scam, appeared in the October 13th issue of the magazine. Don, you were just introducing us into the history of this this vestige of the 1970s energy policy that survives, and it's kept alive, isn't it, by a sort of less by science, because this doesn't seem to do anything good for the environment that I can tell, than by politics, by its Washington connection. Talk about that.
You're absolutely correct, Jack. This is solely there by virtue of Congress, which has kept it alive. IRS has made several attempts to do away with this on its own, which obviously it's not in a position to do. It's had and initiated audits several times. Congress has applied pressure and forced them to back off. And as recently as July, one of the congressional committees actually had an 8-8 vote to kill an IRS investigation, which is really kind of unprecedented.
The investigation into this 1970s program that basically, as you show, is a sort of legal scam.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And, forget the companies like to say, and they are absolutely correct, that they are doing nothing wrong. They are merely taking advantage of a law that's on the books that Congress put there. And what are we supposed to do? That's, Congress did that. If Congress wants to do away with it, they can do away with it. And you don't have to look really any further. Don't look at the companies that are claiming the credit. Look at the companies that came up with the technology, quote, put that technology in quotes, to change the chemical composition of coal. And one of them is this Las Vegas, kind of a mysterious Las Vegas enterprise by the name of Verthco, one of whose founding principals has been censored by the Commodities Future Trading Commission. He's actually been banned from trading because he pilfered millions of dollars from customers. That's using the words of the administrative law judge who imposed a $10 million fine. This is a man who lives in a million-dollar home just off the Las Vegas Strip, and out of that home runs more than 80 corporations with names like 481TL LLC, which suggests that they're probably tax avoidance vehicles, just as the Sinfuel credit is. But you look at companies like this, and these are the companies that are providing the technology.
And one of the arguments made for it, of course, is that this provides jobs. But as you say, the jobs come at the price of $200,000 per job from the taxpayers.
Well,
those are good jobs.
Yeah. We kind of actually lowballed that, giving them more credit for more jobs than they're actually creating, because most of the jobs would be there. Most of these mining jobs would be there one way or the other. It's probably closer in the neighborhood of $500,000 per job. It'd be, it'd be a lot simpler just to create a straightaway welfare program and cut checks for people.
Yes. Well, let's hear David Goldstein on this. He's Energy Program Director at the National Resource Defense Council and a 2002 MacArthur Fellow. Welcome, David.
Thanks, Jack.
Are we in danger in bash? We're talking about just this one subsidy program, although Mr. Barlett's article goes through a whole raft of programs started by presidents back to Nixon, which really have failed and which have cost the taxpayer billions. But are we in danger of throwing the baby out with the bathwater as we bash subsidies here?
Well, I don't think we need to bash subsidies as such, or incentives, to put it even more broadly. The failure of the Bush energy policy is that you really have to identify what is the problem you're trying to solve, and then go into what Don was doing, ask, how do you solve it that really addresses the problem?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what is the problem? The problem is we had a blackout this summer, and we have high natural gas prices. So energy security is a problem. People are paying too much for energy. Most people, most businesses think their bills are too high. That's a real problem. And energy produces a lot of pollution. That's a real problem. So the question you have to ask, does a particular federal policy or federal payment solve any of those problems?
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to see how syn fuels or most of the oil, gas, nuclear subsidies would make much of a difference in the things that people really care about, even if they worked, which, as Don points out, they tend not to.
Mm-hmm.
The question you then have to ask, first of all, what do you want to do? And then how do you want to do it? Let's say that you want to reduce energy costs. The easiest way to do this, which has been demonstrated throughout the country by progressive utilities, is to reduce consumption. That, first of all, means if you're the one whose consumption is reduced and you're getting the same services or better, you're paying less on your bill. But secondly, if someone else's consumption is reduced, that reduces the supply and it makes prices go down just due to market forces.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do it? You do it based on successful experience of the last couple of years by not providing what I'll call a subsidy, which means if you pay a dollar, the government pays 50 cents, because
mm-hmm.
all that does is it encourages you to charge $1.50 and just pocket the extra 50 cents.
Right.
What you do instead is you provide an incentive based on achieving a goal for whatever cost it costs you to get to the goal. So, for example, there are incentives in the Senate energy bill for efficient air conditioners.
Mm-hmm.
A consumer who buys a super efficient air conditioner that uses a third less power at the peak when we're in most in danger of blackouts would get $250.
That's a good incentive.
He'd get $250 whether the air conditioner costs $1,000 extra or $500 extra or nothing extra at all.
I see.
So this creates market forces mm-hmm. for the producers, first of all, to market this product,
mm-hmm.
which you can buy today, but mm-hmm. they're really hard to find, and secondly, to cut prices on it so that they can sell more than their competitors.
Now, that's a kind of subsidy, but it's not the sort of subsidy that goes directly, say, to the energy company.
That's right. This is
this goes to the consumer.
It really doesn't so much matter who it goes to. What mm-hmm. it matters is that it's structured in a way that the producer has the incentive to cut costs and
right.
the consumer has the incentive to shop around.
What about the subsidies for the hydrogen car? And I believe there's some solar subsidies in this bill, too.
Well, hydrogen may be the long-term answer for automobiles. But before you can get to hydrogen, you've just got to get better fuel economy from current vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
So what's more exciting in the Senate version of the bill are incentives for higher technology cars that get more miles per gallon. This is the so-called CLEAR Act.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, there are incentives for...
those would be for taxpayers, for consumers.
For consumers who buy the more efficient cars.
You would be able to write off how much on your taxes for buying these cars?
Well, it depends on the type of technology and how sophisticated the technology
mm-hmm.
is in the car, but it could be as much as a couple $1,000s.
Oh, really?
It's real money.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, for commercial buildings, for schools,
mm-hmm.
for office buildings, for retail stores, there's an incentive in the Senate bill for buildings that can cut their energy bill in half.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty ambitious goal, but NRDC has managed to achieve it in our four buildings, so we know it's possible. And this sort of incentive can jumpstart the whole industry and produce hundreds of thousands of jobs within the next 20 years and save consumers, this is primarily business consumers, tens of billions of dollars a year if it catches on the way similar programs have caught on in the past.
Don Barlett, does any of this make you feel like deja vu all over again? I mean, these sound like great ideas, but your article chronicles how one after another, syn fuels, liquefied natural gas, on and on, have foundered.
David, Jack, I have to tell you, I don't think Jim and I could agree more with what David said. It only made one paragraph in the story. We're always lamenting we don't have as much space in a magazine as we did in a newspaper, but we made the point that in the 70s and 80s, incentives in particularly in energy conservation really did work. People
mm-hmm.
got just
mm-hmm.
what David's talking about for insulating their homes and putting new windows in and doing all sorts of things like that really did cut consumption. That makes sense. What doesn't make sense is to give a credit to corporations to produce a fuel that's the same fuel that's being produced. That's just illogical.
Hmm. Let's take a call from David in Boston. Hello.
Hi. I'm listening to the discussion and wondering about putting it in the context of national security and what's gone on over the last 30 years. He mentioned the oil crisis of 1974. We fought two wars in Iraq. We maintain bases in Saudi Arabia and around the Mideast. The major reason that's going on is strategic significance of oil there. If we lessen dependence on oil, we lessen the cost we spend in terms of human life and money in the Middle East. So when you put it in that context, the idea of a $10,000 per car subsidy for a car that gets 50 or 75 miles per gallon is not far-fetched. But when you talk about it in the current debate, people say too expensive, big government, whatever else.
Yes.
So compared to an $87 billion request,
right?
Why aren't we talking about it that way and talking about some of the ideas of putting money in the hands of consumers to create incentives in that context?
Got you. Thank you very much, David. David Goldstein, how about you?
Well, I completely agree with the listener, except for one thing. It doesn't make sense to throw too much money at the problem because you're trying, as Don was pointing out earlier, not to create permanent subsidies, but just to prime the pump, to get things going. And after that, these efficiency technologies and renewable energy technologies are going to be cost effective and they'll succeed on their own. You just need to get them started. The issue of national security is one that it puzzles me why nobody is taking it seriously from a point of view of policy, because due to America's excessive dependence on oil and the fact that our technologies are used throughout the whole world is sending far too much money to governments in the Middle East that are probably leaking a certain fraction of it through to terrorist organizations. If we can reduce the amount of money being spent for oil worldwide, we will enhance national security dramatically.
It's a case of blood for oil, isn't it? Quite literally, the blood of our soldiers.
Well, you know, David put his finger right on it. There's no institutional memory anymore in Washington. I mean, this is what led to all of the, some of the really good energy initiatives that came out of the 1970s. But everyone has forgotten that the real reason was we were never going to again be subject to the whims of foreign suppliers. And here we are in a far worse position today than we were in the 1970s, and no one in Congress is paying the slightest bit of attention to it. Everyone is just keeping their fingers crossed and sort of hoping that there's going to be a multiplicity of suppliers which might solve the problem, but which is really very doubtful. So we're swinging from maybe Saudi Arabia to Russia to pin our hopes on. And nobody is looking at China. China is just getting ready to enter the auto age. Once the Chinese and the oil companies are going in and opening service stations, once the Chinese become big automobile consumers and gasoline consumers, that is really going to throw the supply and demand scenario out of whack.
Indeed. Let's take another call from Dana in South Wellfleet, Massachusetts. Hello.
Hello. Good evening. Well, I'm really excited by what I'm hearing here, these different things going back and forth. And what's coming to my mind, as I told the screen, is consumption. That's the cycle, in my opinion, that has to be broken at the scale it's done, at least in our country and other, so-called industrialized countries. I think Bush is disingenuous in his policies. He doesn't care about national crises. He cares more about his the people who put him in power, the corporations.
Production consumption, though, that's sort of the basis of modern industry and capitalism. So that's a big thing to change.
It has to, I think. In a way, I mean, to a degree, it has to change. I'm not saying we should all,
right.
become a
sure.
You know, but I really think, though, that I mean, you said China becoming entering into the auto age.
Yes.
I mean, maybe someone should advise them against depending, you know, having the love affair with the automobile that America has. I think there are a lot of I would want to base in order to answer the question posed tonight. I would like to see an energy policy based on conservation rather than production and consumption.
Yes.
I think the market should be heavily regulated, much more than it is now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a word you're never going to hear out of Washington, conservation. Out of Congress, anyways.
Although there are some elements of this bill, it sounds like, that do go in that direction.
Yeah, yes, sort of. But, you know, the one really positive impact out of the earlier energy policies were the mileage requirements imposed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those have all kind of collapsed with the advent of the SUVs being treated as trucks, and there's absolutely no initiative, and there's no inclination whatsoever to deal with those.
Yes, and we need to notice bipartisanly that the attempt to raise the so-called CAFE standards, which was pushed by Senator McCain, a Republican, and Senator Kerry, a Democrat, was defeated by a consortium of the parties, but a prominent role played by Dick Gephardt.
Absolutely. This is not a partisan issue. There are members of both parties on both sides of this issue.
I think this is an issue of just, as Don was saying earlier, looking at the facts, looking at the history, and see where government interventions have worked and how they've worked and where they've failed. We have a pretty competitive economy on the production side, and it's the argument for the government intervening to help production of fossil fuels or established supply industries doesn't seem to have much support. But there's plenty of evidence about how markets have failed in providing new technologies for efficiency. Throughout the economy, if you have a technology that could return 30%, 50% on investment,
mm-hmm.
And cut energy use in half or by 30%, it won't sell. And so we know that miles per gallon standards, building efficiency standards work, and they'll make market forces work better. We know that targeted incentives, not ones like Don was criticizing that last forever, but ones that sunset after
mm-hmm.
a couple of years,
mm-hmm.
work, because we've seen them work at the state level, both through utility programs and through tax incentive programs. So we can actually do something to solve these problems if we think about the solution. And I completely agree with Don. This is not a progressive versus conservative or Democrat versus Republican issue, because some of the best tax incentive proposals in the current bill come from legislation that was sponsored by conservative Republicans and liberal Democrats as co-authors.
David Goldstein, thank you very much for your contribution.
Thank you.
David Goldstein is Energy Program Director of the National Resource Defense Council. He joined us from San Francisco. We're talking about the energy bill in Congress now and about America's energy future. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the Bush energy plan that's pending now in Congress. Why can't America, with its ample subsidies to promote alternative energy sources, break its dependence on foreign oil? Do you want an energy bill that focuses on production or conservation? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Donald Barlett. He's editor-at-large at Time Incorporated and winner of two Pulitzer Prizes. His story, The Great Energy Scam, appeared in the October 13th issue of that magazine. Also with us from Cleveland is Jonathan Adler, assistant professor of law at Case Western University and a contributing editor at the National Review. He's the author of Ecology, Liberty, and Property, a free market environmental reader, and The Costs of Kyoto, Climate Change Policy and Its Implications. Jonathan Adler, welcome.
Good to be here.
You've been listening to this conversation about the pros and cons, well, candidly, mostly about the cons of this energy bill pending in Congress. What's your, if I may say, conservative take on it?
Well, I'd offer two thoughts. First, I certainly agree with much of what we've heard about how government has historically done a poor job of picking winners and losers in energy markets. When you put subsidy money on the table, it tends to be the old slow companies that are around today mm-hmm. that gobble it up, not the companies of tomorrow that will be developing better and more efficient energy technologies. And I think that's inherent in the nature of the political process, inherent in the nature of politically controlled subsidy programs. So insofar as the energy bill throws subsidies at a lot of different industries, and it certainly does that in spades, it clearly is a step in the wrong direction. I think there are some other parts of the energy bill which are certainly not as headline-grabbing, which are significant and are worthwhile.
Let's hear about those.
Well, so one of the things that from the beginning of when the Bush administration came in office was looking at the way existing policies, whether they are energy policies or environmental policies, can get in the way of improvements in electricity reliability or efficiency. We certainly have gasoline regulations, which have served to balkanize gasoline markets regionally in the country, making parts of the country more susceptible to regional price shocks. And then also looking at ways to improve not only the reliability of the electricity grid, but also move towards more market-based pricing of transmission and market-based pricing of electricity on the retail level, insofar as the administration has been looking at those sorts of alternatives and pushing electricity policy in that direction, it's certainly a welcome step.
This is part of that bill.
There are some little parts in the bill relating with the last part in terms of the sort of authority it gives to FERC. Much of the rest is being done administratively by the administration in terms of mandating reviews within the Department of Energy and other agencies. Mm-hmm.
So these are elements that you approve of and that think that the bill and commend the bill for, but they are outweighed or at least balanced by these elements that you don't like, helping the $10 billion subsidy to the oil and gas industry.
Yeah, I mean, when you add up all the subsidies for oil, for coal, for nuclear, for ethanol, and even, I think, for some of the alternative fuel subsidies, which haven't been very effective historically and I don't think mm-hmm. will be very effective now, it certainly is a real question whether on net this is a good bill. Mm-hmm. There's certainly a lot of pork lording this thing up.
Is that what makes its passage inevitable, Don Barlett, the pork?
This is actually an interesting question because this bill was supposed to pass back in July, then it was supposed to pass the end of September. Now there's actually talk about pushing it off until next year, although there's been that hasn't been too well received. But I think it's just still open to question what's going to happen to this piece of legislation.
Where does the opposition come from?
Well, again it's both parties. It doesn't. This is not a Democrat mm-hmm. Republican mm-hmm. issue. I mean, it is both parties. You have the pro-ethanol people. You have the anti-ethanol mm-hmm. people. What Jonathan was saying is absolutely right. This is this balkanization of the gasoline formulation is just nuts in this country.
This is the business where in California there's a particular additive that's sold there. In the East, it's something else. That sort
yes. of thing. Yes, and it goes even way beyond there. And so it does. It creates bottlenecks all through this distribution system as to what, mm-hmm. getting the product to the right gas stations in the right states. Mm-hmm. Not very efficient, not very effective.
And yet, Jonathan, as we've heard about this bill, it's been ANWR, that's all we've heard about, which is the opening up of the Alaska wilderness to oil development or exploration. That is the part of the bill that, at least in my reading, sounds like it's not going to survive. And yet, hasn't that kind of screened all these other things in the bill?
Well, I mean, it certainly gets the most attention. Mm-hmm. And I think that's both because the advocates of drilling in ANWR and the opponents of drilling in ANWR both exaggerate their case.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question, if you talk to any energy economist, that ANWR will do very little to affect U.S. energy security, will do very little to reduce oil imports.
Mm-hmm.
And so the proponents of drilling certainly exaggerate that. I also think that the opponents of drilling exaggerate the environmental impact. We've had many examples of rural development in ecologically sensitive areas going back decades, many of them on lands owned or managed by environmental organizations, that have shown that it is possible to have oil development in an ecologically sound way.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, while the other Alaska oil developments did not have the negative environmental impact that many feared. So I think in both cases, ANWR is the impact of the decision of whether to drill is being exaggerated.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, we tend to focus on ANWR, and we tend to ignore all the handouts and subsidies that are piled on.
Yes, and one of the things it sounds like we're ignoring, Don, you get into this, is the pipeline for natural gas leading from Alaska down to the lower 48. That is more expensive than it needs to be, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it's going really out of the way. I mean, this is another case of a proposal that came up back in the 70s and was shot down. We didn't need it at the time. It was thought, let me back up here a minute. There's something really interesting going on. The sidebar to that main story that appeared in Time dealt with the production of oil sands out of Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And this was very similar to oil shale in the western U.S., except the Canadians subsidized it, got it started, and then the industry took off on its own, and it's now very, very profitable, and we're buying
mm-hmm.
this synthetic fuel. It'll be up to probably 1 million barrels a day within a year. Now, you can make all kinds of arguments whether you want to do that, and one of the arguments you can make is, well, it's very energy-intensive to get the oil out of the sand, which it is. The Canadians do it by virtue of burning natural gas. Well, the U.S. is heavily dependent on natural gas from Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Now, all of a sudden, the Canadians are going to have to begin shifting natural gas that they were selling and are selling to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
into the production of the synthetic crude oil from the oil sands if they're really going to expand those operations. So you have all of these twists and policies going on that are not just in this country, but in Canada and in Mexico. Mexico is a basket case. Mexico should be totally self-sufficient, and we're sending 100,000 barrels of gasoline a day to Mexico.
Scott is calling from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Welcome.
Thank you. I agree with the earlier caller who said that I think this is actually a national security issue. And in that light, it's always puzzled me why part of our program, particularly if our legislators seem dedicated to the idea of subsidizing big business, why we don't subsidize rather than oil companies, why we don't subsidize alternative energy companies with using the following strategy. Make an effort to shift utility, therefore consumer electricity producers, off of fossil fuels onto geothermal or hydro or nuclear, et cetera. We could subsidize those industries to the legislators' heart's content, and thereby free up gasoline for our vehicle fleet in this country, and overall, I think, decrease the dependence on foreign gasoline simply because we won't have to bring as much of the darn stuff in.
Right.
And I think that would be. I wonder if that's a viable.
So you're
solution.
Saying shift the subsidies. If you're going to subsidize these alternative sources to get
right.
them going. All right, let's try that on Jonathan Adler. What about green subsidies, Jonathan?
I'm skeptical for two reasons. One, we've had subsidies for a lot of alternative fuels going back decades, and they have never delivered what they promised. Where we have seen successes in the development of energy technologies and alternative fuels, it's usually been from areas other than where the government was subsidizing. The sorts of solar energy projects, for example, that the federal government subsidized heavily in the 1970s and 80s produced very little. The area where we see advance in solar has been things that have been more market-driven, more the result of private investment. Secondly, I think when we look at the issue of energy security, we need to understand something about the nature of oil markets, and that is oil is a global commodity. And whether or not we are vulnerable to price shocks in global oil markets is not a function of the percent of oil that we get from overseas. It's a function of how much oil we use in our economy as a whole. And even an example to illustrate the point, in 1979 when we saw global oil prices shoot through the roof, the United Kingdom, which was entirely self-sufficient in its own oil production, that is, it produced all of its own oil, but yet used lots of oil. Oil was one of its major energy sources. The United Kingdom was economically devastated by the ramp up in oil prices. Japan, on the other hand, which produces almost none of its own oil,
mm-hmm.
but gets most of its energy from non-oil sources, was hardly affected at all. It's a function of the role of oil in our overall energy mix, not whether or not it comes from Alaska, Texas,
or
the Middle East.
Gotcha. Let's take a call from Barbara in Providence, Rhode Island. Hello.
Yes. I'm interested in how much emphasis is being placed on nuclear and how much emphasis is placed on going into Anwar in Alaska and how much maybe off the coast of California. We have a different governor out there.
Yes, let's hear about that. Don Barlett, how about nuclear?
Well, I don't think there's any emphasis on nuclear. I mean, the last nuclear plant was ordered in the 1970s, and there doesn't appear to be anything that's going to change that.
But you do say there are subsidies here in this bill for nuclear, are there not?
I'm not sure there are for nuclear.
Oh, I see. I thought you had.
I believe they increase the liability exemption for.
That's
nuclear.
What it is. Yeah, you're right.
Which certainly is a subsidy. I mean, it's not the same as writing a check, but it is a subsidy.
Yes, that's correct.
And how about offshore drilling in California?
I'm not sure what the bill does for that. I mean, that's, one of the things everybody holds up. But I think, the point Jonathan made was absolutely right on the money. You can open up Anwar. Let's forget all of the environmental issues. Open it up. It's not going to have any effect whatsoever in the long-term supply of fuel in this country. It just isn't enough there. The long-term trend is straight down, and whatever comes out of it would come out of Anwar would only be a slight blip. Same thing for the offshore area. Not enough there. You got to remember that this is the most heavily drilled real estate on the face of the earth, and
that is the California shelf.
Well, no, the U.S.
The U.S.
General.
Okay.
The U.S. in general. And one example: in the last 3 years, there were like 20,000 natural gas wells drilled, more in any 3-year period in history. It didn't do anything but keep production flat. There are no, there are no giant fields to be found in this country, and so production is not the answer here.
Jonathan, do you join with that thought that production is not the answer? Is conservation then the answer?
Well, I think two things. I think one that the idea that we're going to produce our way out of energy, produce our way into energy independence, certainly is folly. Especially since if oil is cheaper overseas than it is in the United States, when oil prices go down, then production in the United States is going to go offline, and that's certainly what we saw in the 80s. That's why a lot of oil production in Texas slowed down, because it wasn't economical compared to oil from elsewhere. In terms of conservation, I think the thing that we often don't like to recognize is that the surest way to drive conservation is to let energy prices go up. That's how markets tend to encourage efficiency. When the cost of an input goes up, companies look for ways of economizing on that input.
Yes, and our friend Tom Friedman has been advocating a dollar a gallon gasoline tax increase just on those grounds. Jonathan, whether or not you favor that, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jonathan Adler, assistant professor of law at Case Western Reserve University, and Don Barlett of Time Incorporated, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Jack.
I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.